This is an interview that I recorded back in my old office in Santa Monica. You remember the one, right? The one with all the books behind me? Well, it's sponsored by three companies, Grasshopper.com, RichWP.com, and Shopify.com. Check them out, and here's the interview. Hey everyone, it's Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of MixSurgery.com, home of the ambitious upstart. And if you've watched my past interviews, you know that I'm obsessed with doing interviews with people who are actually charging their users. I want to learn how, don't you? How in a world where everyone assumes that everything online is free, how are there some renegade companies who are willing to say our products are so good that people should pay for them? And in fact, if people do pay for them, we can give them a better experience. So charging makes the product better than it was already to begin with. How are these people doing it? More importantly, what can you, what can I, what can everyone else who's building a business online learn from them? Well, I've got one of these renegades. It's right here on Mixergy today. His name is Mike McDermott, and he is the co-founder and CEO of a company called FreshBooks. FreshBooks, as many of you already on Mixergy know, is an online invoicing system, and it does so much more than that. So here's my interview with Mike, where we find out from him, and you'll see, I ask specific questions. We find out how he's able to create a product that people are willing to pay for and what you can learn from him. Here it is.
My name is Mike McDermott. I'm the co-founder and CEO of FreshBooks, and we're the leader in online invoicing for people, professionals to get paid for their time and expertise.
All right. And who founded the company?
Myself and a gentleman named Joe Sawada.
How did you and Joe meet?
Well, as a matter of fact, we met on a cold, dark Canadian night playing Ultimate Frisbee, or Ultimate Disc Golf, rather, in a snowy park with a... we might have had a couple drinks along with us.
All right. And so did you guys hit it off professionally right away, or were you just friends at first?
Yeah, we were introduced through a mutual friend. And what happened was... I was running a design firm at the time, really with a focus on internet marketing, and we were helping small businesses basically improve their online presences. And I'd started this in 1999, and this was like 2002. And Joe, I met him, I guess January 2003, so it was 2003. Joe started doing some contract work for me as a developer, you know, if I were to get into the rest of the story, that's how we met. So we started off with disc golf and moved into some contract work, and then eventually founded a company together.
Oh, cool. Okay, so let's get into then where the idea came from.
Right. So, Andrew, have you ever invoiced anybody using Word or Excel?
Yes.
Okay. Doesn't sound like that was a particularly nice experience.
You know what? You'd
Maybe
think
you
actually that Excel comes with a template for it. And so does Word. You'd think that Word would be very easy to use because it gives you the full template. It tells you to put your name and an address on top, I think it is. But they make even that simple invoice too complicated.
Right. So the fact is, neither Word nor Excel were built for invoicing. And I was using a combination of Word and Excel to do my invoicing back for my design shop. And one day I was sending an invoice to a repeat customer, and I opened up an old invoice. I put the new information in, and I saved it. And I failed to do a very important thing. I failed to rename that file. So I lost the old invoice and all the data in it. And I said to myself, you know, there just has to be a better way than this. And so this was, you know, again, January 2003, not long after I met Joe. And I spent the next 2 weeks of my spare time, and I built an online invoicing service for my customers. I wanted them to see the kinds of things I could do. And I really wanted to just, you know, I never thought of using a piece of accounting software. I just really needed invoicing. And and so I built it out. And, over time, the service has evolved.
So you developed it yourself? You're a developer?
Nobody here at the office would call me a developer. I'm a total hack, and you know, I haven't written a line of code since probably February 2003.
Wow.
Joe took that over once he started getting involved with the project, and I focus more on design, development, and marketing.
Okay, here's something that I've noticed in a lot of my interviews. Successful companies very often start with something that's very simple. Like Guy Kawasaki might say, "Don't worry, be crappy." I'd love to hear what your first version looked like, with all its scars, with all its warts, just to get a sense of what it was.
Yeah, crappy would be kind. So yeah, I mean, it was terrible. It was kind of state of the art too. You got to imagine that, you know, we actually came to market in May 2004. You know, we started development in you know, early 2003, and there really weren't any web frameworks or anything to speak of. When you think about all the knowledge that's out there today for somebody who's building a web application, you think of the guys at 37 Signals who've done an awesome job, you know, sharing how things are done. Well, we were off in a corner learning all those lessons for ourselves. You know, I remember they've written a great book called Getting Real, which I recommend to anybody who's thinking about getting into the web application business. And, you know, as I say, we had to learn all those lessons for ourselves, by ourselves, off in the dark. And getting access to, you know, mentors and advisors to build this kind of business was, you know, frankly, next to impossible because nobody really had. You know, there was Hotmail and there was Salesforce, and that was about it.
I see. Sorry, first of all, I want to thank a couple of people who are watching us live. Who is Vince and Mia, who've seen you, who've been following you, I guess, online and are telling people to come watch us. Thank you guys.
Sure.
So what did it look like? What was the design of it? What was the functionality?
Okay, sorry, good question. So, I mean, in some ways, you might say it didn't look much different than it does today. You know, there was like a tab navigation architecture, there was a lot more use of gray, so it was kind of drab and dreary. It was more, I would say, more boxy than it is, though we don't use a hell of a lot of rounded corners. We just try to get away with those without using those conventions at all where we can. A lot of the activities like generating an invoice just didn't happen as smoothly as they do today. Input boxes were the wrong sizes in some case. People need to put more information, less information. I don't know. It's hard to go back there. And articulate it in a way. But I mean, think 2003. Web application, not Hotmail, not Salesforce. and that's kind of like the best I can do to describe it. But you know, it was usable enough that people did in fact use it. And some of those people are still using it today.
Okay. So from what I've seen, a lot of entrepreneurs start off as consultants, building out applications for other people, learning along the way, and also making money to keep their business growing. And then they want to take the leap into creating their own product because a product scales, because a product is less, well, I guess because a product scales and because it's more profitable. But it's hard to make that leap. Why did you guys make that leap successfully?
I wouldn't say that, you know, you said it's more profitable. It's not more profitable for a good long while. I mean, we were able to invest
Good point.
in ourselves with my consulting business to fund the growth of the business. You know, these businesses, it's easy to develop the product, but to get the marketing and the adoption and what have you to actually build a meaningful business, that's the challenge. I mean, the technology, frankly speaking, is the easy part. It's the marketing and the awareness in the marketplace that's a heck of a lot harder.
Okay, so after you built out the first version of this, how did you start marketing it?
Right. So from day one, so my background first up was, you know, I was helping small businesses do their internet marketing. And we had some pretty significant clients in the travel and real estate spaces, so we were pretty good at this. But I will say this, from day one, and we were good at it from a spend money, get results standpoint. Okay, so from day one, we spent on advertising and we went into some targeted niches. And my background was like in SEO and things like that. So we bought, you know, a $400 ad in like a newsletter for internet marketing consultants and things like that. And so we generate trials from that kind of thing. We weren't really savvy about blogging or anything like that at the time. And those things were just really, you know, in their nascence as well. You know, to some extent, there were blogs out there certainly, but, you know, not the way I would say. 2004, 2005, 2006, you know, they became much more common and better understood. And we got, you know, blogging ourselves in, you know, 2004, 2005. So anyways, 2003, we're buying ads in newsletters. We were doing some pay-per-click advertising because I knew a thing or two about that. You know, and those were the primary ways of doing things. We tried a PR firm and fell on our faces. We spent, you know, quite
Oh no.
Hey, Andrew.
Hey, sorry about that. Not sure what happened, but I'm glad we're able to get back on. It's
Stay
okay.
there. Yeah,
We'll just
okay.
edit it back in together, so we should be okay. So, sorry,
Awesome.
you're saying that you tried a PR firm.
Yeah, we tried a PR firm here. I'm just going to invite you. Oh, no. I can't see you. Can you
Oh,
invite
yeah,
me?
here, let me bring myself back up here. All
Perfect.
right, there we
Okay,
go.
thank you. Yeah, so we tried a PR firm. And I like to say I got my master's in communications through that process because we didn't get any awareness built out of it whatsoever. And so we shelved that and we went back to putting our heads down and spending our money on sort of direct response type marketing, like being in an email newsletter or pay-per-click, and started trying to learn a little more about who was being successful marketing themselves online. This is where we started learning more about blogging and that kind of thing.
I'm sorry to dig deeper into it, but I'm a business nerd, so I've got to keep asking questions about this. The PR, what were you hoping to get from PR?
I'd say like a story in a newspaper, right? We thought, and this is kind of a funny thing too, because we thought that would, change the game for us, right? All of a sudden, everyone know about us. They start buying our service. It's going to be awesome. And I can tell you, we've had lots of newspaper articles written about us subsequently, and frankly, the impact has been relatively meaningless. In fact, the greatest value has often been to go back to our own customers and say, "Hey, we were in this article," and they can just get excited about the validation of what they already knew, which is, awesome business. You guys are great.
What about the value of just having the logo of the media that you were covered in on your website? Does that increase conversions?
Actually, you know what? There's no question that that is a compelling. You need third-party validation in your marketing. And so yes, actually having like a like the Wall Street Journal as a logo who's written about you, maybe a link to the article, or the LA Times, or we're just on Entrepreneur Magazine. So something like that, it really it helps validate. And when people are trying to decide whether or not you are a a trustworthy business, or whether this application that they've stumbled across has any merit, that third-party validation from a national newspaper, or I was on Fox Business News one day. Like it is a compelling conversion tool for a lot of prospective purchasers.
That's what I'm finding, but in your experience, it doesn't drive enough traffic to your site to give you a meaningful number of customers.
The value is in how you repurpose it.
I see. Okay, but you did say that you knew about pay-per-click advertising. How'd you get that experience?
Well, so in the business I was running beforehand, to give you more on my backstory, I was running an event business. I built myself a website because a good way to communicate information. Once I taught myself how to build websites, because I did one each year, I said, other people need these, and I started building websites for small businesses. And around that time, just common sense said, what's the point in building one of these things unless people show up? So I started to get interested in SEO and these kinds of things, a very white hat SEO. But SEO nonetheless. And then, so AdWords came to be. In fact, even before that, there was Overture through Yahoo. So started to understand those things and read up on those and offer, those services to my small business customers. Hey, we can generate leads for you by helping to, you can purchase advertising through these mechanisms, and we can help you track them. And, when I finished off, we were really just doing consulting. So we go to a large company who was doing, their conversion rate was 0.5% on their website, and they're doing 1 million in sales. And we'd say, listen, we can take you to 2%. Just sign here, and we'll help you out with that. So, yes. So that's where I got my background. And ironically, I'll tell you, we outsource that now. That's I don't. I used to do these services, and we outsource them now ourselves.
I see. Okay, so that's where you were able to get your customers in the early days. How much did it help you that you were charging?
Well, that's a tough question to answer. I'll tell you why. First of all, we had our pricing totally wrong. So we launched. I've noticed I've mixed up a couple of the years in this stuff. So we launched in May 2004. So when I was saying we were buying advertising earlier, I said 2003 by accident. So May 2004 we launched. We were buying advertising through the end of the year. We actually only had 10 paying customers at the end of 2004.
Okay.
Okay, and. But people were using the service and people were signing up for the service. And, you know, by any other measure, from a monetary standpoint, we were a failure, but we believed in what we were doing. We kept going. Now, back then, you used to get 40 clients for free with our service. You know, now you get 3 clients for free. Okay, so I think to get people to use the service, charging wasn't that big a barrier, but being able to sort of monetize the number of people that are using the service, getting the price points right with the freemium model was in fact a bit of a challenge and took us some time.
So how did, well, so you were offering, I think you said 40 free clients, right? Before people had to pay?
Yeah,
30.
Yeah. 40, yeah.
It was 40, yes. Okay. So it's 40 free clients. Yes. So what you were trying to do was buy ads, get people to take the free service, and hope that they were going to need 31 clients to bill, and then at that point you'd get paid.
Exactly. Like, we didn't really know who was going to be the consumer of the service. If I had it to do over again today, and what I recommend to other people is start without having, you know, that business model per se or that charging in place from day one, just so you get people using the service and you get some traction, and just let them know that in the future, you're going to charge them, okay? And they'll have the choice at that point in time, but really it's free for now because we want to get people adopted. Because when you're developing a product and it's in the early stages like this, you need to drive as fast and as hard as you can to getting users who can give you feedback, because they're going to guide you. And that makes all the difference. So, you know, having charging is almost like a barrier for some of those people. But I would also say in some cases it's not that big a barrier and you shouldn't be that afraid of charging. Just make sure that, you know, they can get in there, try it out for free.
Mike, this is really helpful. Okay, so you started out with one price. How did you get to adjust your pricing? How did you get to adjust your offering without confusing your current customers and without confusing new customers as they came in?
So, communications. I mean, first of all, you send a note to people. You don't just raise the prices one day. So, in fact, we actually just raised prices 3 weeks ago. We raised them again. And you know, we told everybody in advance that we were going to do this. And, you know, you can upgrade now if you want to. You know, we encourage them to do so. I mean, that's really it. So you tell them you're going to do it. You give them fair advance warning and set the expectations that you will. And then, you know, at the prescribed time that you told them about, so they're dead clear, you go ahead and raise your prices.
Okay, I had a conversation with someone who sells access to a marketplace online. He buys ads on Google, he gets people to come over to his website and then pay a monthly fee for access to this database. And he said, Andrew, I never put my price on the homepage and I never have my full registration process be one page. What I want is to have two different distinct decisions to give my users. The first is, do you want to sign up for my service? And in that page, I don't give them a price and I don't ask them to pay. The second page, I show them several prices and I see which one they're more likely to pay. You know, small, medium, and large service. And based on that, I can tell whether my price is turning people off or my offering is. So that's a long way for me to come around and ask you, do you have other techniques like that that you can share with us for figuring out how to charge, for getting people to pay?
I wish I could say that I can talk to you about some ideas there. You know, that's really interesting that he's trying to break up those decisions, or she. That's an interesting way of looking at things. I think that makes a lot of sense, actually, the more I think about it. And I guess we've always been doing it that way ourselves. One thing I was going to say is, in your sign-up form, if you can make that one page, I strongly encourage you to do it. We used to have like a 5-step process to get into your account, and you know, we brought it down to one page, and it was much more effective. So that's something to think about there. But effectively, we just got people using the service, and we've just, you know, you kind of need to test these things in some way. And the way we've tested things is we've just gone ahead and lowered the prices. And, you know, you always have the option to change if you see terrible results. But our experience has not been, you know, that the results are terrible. So we've forged on with whatever the new pricing is. You can do cohorting. So you can offer, you know, in different, you got to be careful about the legalities of some of these things. But, you know, different prices or different offers to see which one appeals most to your customer base. And you know, ideally, you never stop testing that kind of thing because sometimes the results are very interesting. And if you can build a framework in your application that lets you simultaneously test different cohorts and what have you, that is a smart thing to do. But I would say when you're just, I'd say that's almost like a later stage thing to do. First of all, build the service, serve people who are signing up and giving you feedback, and deliver, you know, changes based on that feedback to them. And then worry about slapping some kind of pricing on top of it later. And you can, I mean, I think it's a really important thing to keep in mind that people forget is you can always change your pricing. You can always change it. And chances are you probably should change it. It's going to get stale at some point. Maybe you're going up market as a premium offering like FreshBooks, or maybe you're going cheaper, you know, and at the low end because you feel you're being commoditized. I don't know what it is for you, but it should fit with your brand and your brand strategy.
The founder of VentNation.com is watching us live, and he's asking us, how did you figure out your price point? How did you adjust it? Was it just based on feedback and then coming out with a price, or did you have a system in place to keep testing different prices as users came in?
None of the above. You can't get feedback about pricing from your users, because no matter what, they'll say, oh, no, you know, don't raise the, like, they'll assume that you're going to get them. And then sometimes if you tell them, well, listen, what if I told you we were going to raise prices, you know, but yours was going to stay the same? They might say, well, in that case, sure, you know, raise the price. Like, it's, pricing is part art, part science. And I'd almost say it's mostly art. and we've changed our prices now 4 times. Okay, we've raised them every time. And we've lowered the amount of limits that people get when they get their account 3 times. And every time we've done these things, these 7 different events, we've converted more people to more paying customers. And so it goes against everything in you. Like, people who are building businesses, and this is true of consults and stuff as well, is it's really easy to, like, you're going to be the first person to undervalue your own services. So you got to almost constantly push, you know, in a gradual or, you know, process to be charging more, to find out at what point, you know, you lose people.
That's interesting, actually. You're right. We are the first people to undervalue our own services. Where do you think that comes from?
You know, I don't know. Probably somewhere baked into human nature. There's, you know, maybe it's like, you know, I tell you, we don't like to take ourselves too seriously here at FreshBooks, right? I think if you take yourself too seriously, and you know, there are people who think, well, my service is, you know, far more valuable than, frankly, the market is willing to pay. So you have those outliers over there. But I think most of the time, people they undervalue what it is that they do. And you know, I'm sure that's some deep, like, human psychological thing. I don't know what it is, but yeah, there's something there.
Why'd you decide to charge instead of doing what most people seem to be doing at the time, which is give it away for free and hope to make money from advertising and convince yourself that, well, business customers are great for advertisers. I'll be able to charge a lot CPM and build my business without ever charging my users.
Right. A couple of reasons. I think, first of all, I don't like ads in my own applications. So I try to serve myself. Second of all, I'm not crazy about ad-driven businesses as somebody who runs a business, because you're so subject to the market. Third of all, I believe people are willing to pay for value, and I've seen that time and time again. It takes conviction, right? That, you know, you are offering something of value, and you better be sure you are offering something of value. And I think that's, you know, a challenge to know what that is, and sometimes that takes time and testing to understand where the value is in what you offer. But you know, if you can figure that stuff out, frankly, I think a subscription revenue business is basically the best damn business model in the world. And you know, it's our responsibility every month to prove our value to our customer base, you know, through service, through continuing to develop the product, through a whole bunch of different things. And you know, every month we're on the hook for that. But you know, as long as we continue to deliver against that, we have a, you know, good long track record of doing that now, people are willing to pay for the value we offer. And I think one thing that's helpful to do is to try to, and I encourage entrepreneurs to do this when they're building a business, trying to size up an opportunity. And maybe this is the heart of the question. You need to find a way to quantify the value of your service. Okay?
I hope we didn't lose. Sorry, Mike, we're losing you there for a
Pardon
sec.
me?
Okay, we lost you for a second. You were saying you need to find a way to quantify the value of your service.
Yeah, you must find a way to quantify the value of your service. And the way to do this is to poll your users. So get a whole bunch of free users and ask them a question. And it should be an open-ended question. It should not be, how much are you willing to pay for my service? It should be based on one of two things. You know, first, I mean, I can take a step backwards. First of all, you got to understand whether your business is a crayon or an aspirin, okay? CRM, it helps you drive top line, it helps you generate more sales. Okay, that's a crayon. It paints a brighter future, okay? Aspirin is a painkiller. I'm in the aspirin business. Every month I've got to do billing. It hurts my head. I don't want to do it. Make this pain go away, okay? So in the CRM version, something that's going to drive top line for a business, you might want to ask them, you know, your users, by using our service for free, how much new revenue have you generated? Okay, so, you know, I made $1,000 extra this month because of using your service. Okay, in the pain business, you might want to understand, well, how much time have I saved you? And we asked, like, how much time do you spend invoicing before FreshBooks and after in the very early days? Some people spend, you know, save multiple person days a month thanks to our service. Other people, they save 4 hours, right? Now, 4 hours is a half day for, you know, somebody who's busy building their business. Like, you can make phone calls and generate new business in 4 hours. So, I mean, how much is your time worth, right? And if I can save you 4 hours and you bill out at $200 an hour, well, my service is, you know, to my mind, worth $800 a month, okay? So you need to find some mechanism whereby you can say, if I'm helping you get this benefit by virtue of you using my service, you know, I want to reflect my, you know, like, based on that value. So if it's 4 hours, how much is your time worth? Maybe a monthly service costs 1 hour of your time, right? Because we're going to save you three and you can turn that into money. If it's a CRM business generation tool and you can generate $10,000 more a month, well, you'll pay, I bet you any money, you'll pay $1,000 a month for that service if you can generate 10. So as long as, well, in margin, I should say. Anyway, so you kind of get the idea. And I think you can find a structured way to understand the value of your service and then apply that to your pricing.
I see. I love that. Okay. So find a way to attach a value to your service, something measurable, and then poll your users with that instead of asking them how much are you willing to pay.
Absolutely. And really, I mean, I strongly encourage the before and after questions. Like, before you were doing this, how long did this take you? You know, before you were using the service, how great were your sales? Afterwards, they were this, right? And I'll tell you, people generate more revenue thanks to using FreshBooks, believe it or not. But, you know, we believe we're in the aspirin business.
How do they generate more revenue? Because they're billing?
Well, yeah, because they're keeping more accurate records. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they don't lose an hour here or there. Remember how we talked about pricing and how you're the first person to undervalue your services? Andrew, if I ask you 1 week from now, how long took you to prepare to get this interview together? What are you going to say?
Prepare to get this interview together? I'd say a couple of hours.
Okay. So if I ask you a week from now, you'd probably say an hour. There's just something with time and your own value. Mm. Like you start to diminish and discredit your own time. So something like a time tracking tool, like what we do for a lawyer. If you think, well, how long did that take me a week ago? It took me 4 hours. I bet you if you track the time on it, it took you 7.
I see. You're talking about that tool that you have that's part of FreshBooks that people don't know about, that when they sign up, I don't think they recognize this. That tool that lets them say, I'm now working on this project. And then when they're done, they hit pause. Yeah. And then when they come back to the project, they hit play again. And then they really get to see how much time they're putting in.
It's a start-stop timer. But I'll give you another example is, you know, people do some work in, you know, on a project for a client. And if they, I mean, FreshBooks, this is what people tell us is, you know, your software has changed my behavior. You know, that response used to terrify the hell out of me because you don't want software changing behavior. But what they say is, it changed my behavior. And now instead of waiting until the end of the month, I invoice my client immediately after the job. So even if you're not using the time tracker, because the work is fresh in your mind, you're actually going to remember, oh, you know, it actually took me 8 hours. It didn't take me 6. So you're going to charge, you know, your full value as opposed to putting it off, forgetting some of the details, saying to yourself, oh, I'm afraid that this customer is going to be take offense to this bill, whereas you generate the invoice right away, it's for the full amount, and the value that you've delivered is fresh in their minds.
By the way, as we're talking, Scott Mead is writing these incredible notes. Scott, you should be writing the notes on this interview when I post it. He's pointing out that we talked that you said PR value is credibility, not primarily in traffic. It's all about how you repurpose it. Start out with free to get traffic. Remove the barriers to entry. Just let early adopters know to plan that you plan to charge. Here's another thing that he's pointing out. This is a great interview. I've got similar notes here. You can't get feedback about pricing from your users. They'll always say cheaper. Customers say go lower on price, yet raising our prices brought in more conversions. Did you say that, by the way?
Yep.
You did. Wow, Scott, I didn't even catch that part. Guys, if anyone has any questions, please ask them, and I'll make sure to bring up as many of them as I can. What about features? We now talked about prices. How do you figure out what features to add into your product and which ones are just going to overwhelm users?
Features. Feedback. You know, it's and working really hard to not overwhelm them when you implement it, right? Saying no a lot. But you're always walking this balance between, you know, you cannot give people what they ask for. You have to give them what they need. You know, so they'll say, I really want this thing. I want it. If you ask, well, why do you want that? Well, they'll say, oh, I need it because of this. And you can say, you know, I can give you that benefit in a totally different way than you're describing. So you got to listen to people. The other piece is you got to stay true to your vision, okay? And that's a tough balance sometimes, especially in the early days, because you're like, all my users want this, but it's a totally different direction than I had envisioned. And, you know, sometimes those are some dark, long nights when you're wondering, well, do I go where people really want me to go, or where they're telling me they want me to go, or do I go where I believe my vision is taking me? And you have to, you know, you have to always have a little doubt, I think, in your vision so that you are listening to people. But oftentimes you might have to say no to people because you're not going to do what they, you know, they ask for or they're telling you to, because you have a vision that's taking you somewhere else. So again, a little bit part art, part science, product management there.
You know what? Let me dig in deeper to both those points. So the first point you said was when people ask you for features, look for what they need. Do you have an example of that to help illustrate it?
Well, okay. Yeah. I mean, so, well, okay. Let me speak in generics because I think it's actually sort of better. Mm-hmm. Well, let me think about this. I don't know. You can pick any feature. I actually hate the word feature. I'm always trying to develop benefits for people, not features. And so to understand a benefit, you can't ask them to tell you what the feature looks like. You need to ask them, what is it they need? What is it you're trying to achieve by asking me for this? All right, I think people fail to do that sometimes. They take feedback from users very literally. I'll tell you this as well. It's very hard to do this by email. You know, I'm a big fan of the telephone. So we answer the telephone here at FreshBooks if you phone us. Back in the early days when we were working in my parents' basement for like 2.5 years, I would call my customers with, you know, a questionnaire and ask them, you know, what is it that you need? How would you describe our service? You know, if you could change anything or recommend something to us, what is it that you would change? And they'd tell me all this stuff. And then I'd ask them why. Why is such an important question when you get feedback? You know, anytime I talk to somebody, I love your product. Well, why? Tell me why. The fact that you love it, it's very nice to hear. But if I don't understand why, knowing that is of no value to me. But if you can direct me based on, well, you love it for this reason, fantastic. That I can do something with. And maybe I can even do more for you in that vein than I already am.
I see. So when they come to you and they say, I want this extra feature or I want this extra thing put into FreshBooks, you say why. And if you just ask why, it makes their feedback that much more meaningful. And you do it by phone.
Absolutely.
I'm actually going to try
that. And sometimes you can answer. Mm-hmm. So, and half the time it's like, oh, well, we do that. It's just over here. You know, but you know, it's just they had a certain expectation in their mind with like, this is how it works. Okay, so what is it you're looking for again? Why do you need that? Oh, that can be performed over here in this way. Oh, okay, that's great. Thanks a lot. I didn't even have to develop a new feature.
I see. Okay, so then the next thing is you say, well, actually, before we move on past the phone calls, you have your phone number up on your website?
Yes.
I keep hearing that that's an important conversion tool. Have you found the same thing in your business?
You know, we haven't tested that, so I can't say.
Okay. So what made you put it on there then?
We believe in serving Like, FreshBooks is not a technology or a service.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. If you have a question, you deserve an answer. Email us, phone us, Twitter us, go into our forums and ask it. You're going to get a real live human being giving you an intelligent response. That's the business we're in. We just happen to be selling, you know, an invoicing service. But I mean, there's so many people who don't know, you know, they don't know about payment gateways. They don't know about how to organize their expense categories, whatever it is. You know, there's just stuff they don't know. And, you know, we can help them get set up, get started. Maybe they're uncertain about something. Often it's a workflow thing. I don't know, you know, this is how I do things. Can I do this with you? Like, so, you know, we're here for people. And, you know, I believe it's our responsibility to just make it easy for people to communicate with us however they want to communicate with us. That's what led us onto Twitter in the early days. That's why we have a phone number up there. That's why we respond to email. We just want to make it easy for you to get in touch with us, because, frankly, I believe the customers have all the answers if you listen correctly. So you got to do as much listening as you can, which means you need to get as much feedback as you can, which means you need to make it as easy as possible for people to get in touch with you.
I see. And how long does it take for people to pick up the phone at FreshBooks if we call up that 800 number?
I don't know. You should try.
You know what? I would like to. Do you mind? When I talked to Tony Shea, he said our customer service is different from anyone else. I said, what if I call it at the end? He said, go for it. I did.
Yeah.
I'll give it a shot. For anyone who's live, we'll get to see what that's like. All right. The second thing you said earlier that I want to dig in deeper is, where is that? Wrestling with the vision. That you have a vision for where you want your business to go. You know what you want it to be. I imagine that people must be coming into you and suggesting all kinds of things that are related to finance, related to billing, related to keeping track of the books, but also different from your vision. How do you know what to let in and what not to?
You know, part art, part science. I think anything that, I mean, I'll tell you, in the early days, right, we put in a bunch of stuff that wasn't really a great fit. You know, for those people in sort of the more IT-oriented disciplines, FreshBooks actually has a support ticketing capability inside the product. It's kind of the black sheep of the family. It's not even on by default when you go in there, but it's there if you want to use it. We have another thing, which is a document sharing capability. So you can do file sharing with permissions, same deal. Those things were in there. We actually have been, focused on things that were more core to our offering. Like, you know, invoicing, time tracking, expenses, sending estimates to customers for, you know, various projects. So all of which is to say, I got it wrong, really, really wrong in the early days, many times over. And so it's not easy, but I think in time you start to get, as you get more feedback from people, you know, you start to understand and you have your vision in your head, you start to understand, you know, oh, okay, this is something that fits, or this is something that isn't. And, you know, I would say, I mean, the guys, again, I think they articulated it really, really well, so I can't really do a better job of that. The guys at 37 Signals, they talk about the 80-20 rule. You know, if 80% of your customers need it and only 20% don't, well, maybe you should consider it. But, you know, it's just a framework to figure out if something is worth even discussing, in my opinion.
So you're saying that your customers ask you for document sharing. You thought it would be a good, they didn't even.
I'm saying they didn't. You know, I had this like, oh, this stuff's all useful. I can use it for my business, right?
Mm.
You know, and so like, that was an example of where, you know, and I would even say like, you know, my vision wasn't clear. It was just like, here's useful stuff. We'll put it in there. Put it, I'll like it, right? As opposed to like, okay, we want to be a focused application, you know, that delivers a certain kind of value to a certain kind of customer. And, you know, at the end of the day, while those things are valuable to a percentage of the customer base, they're not core to our offering. So let's phase them out, so to speak. And not so much phase them out. Like, we maintain them, support them, and, you know, one day we'll probably invest in them in new and different ways. But we've turned our attention to other parts of the application.
So today, knowing what you know now, if you woke up one morning and said, I could use a document sharing program, I think we should include it in FreshBooks. How would you go about figuring out whether it's the right thing to include or not?
Well, I'll tell you, today I know all the stuff we need to do. I'm just looking forward to having the time to get it all done, right? Like, it's a totally different, like, thing. I wouldn't, if it's pretty doubtful. I mean, sometimes I wake up and, but anything that I'm thinking of that we need today, it's like I need it for, much further off into the future. And if I still believe I need it at that point in time, then we'll build it. And sometimes things become less important over time. So I actually find that time is a good pruner of the roadmap. You're never going to have enough time. You're never going to have enough resources. If you had all the time and resources in the world, you'd probably build one terrible piece of software. But by virtue of not having that, you kind of weed out stuff that, it was great today or it was great 6 years ago, right? But today, nobody's asking for that anymore.
Okay. Before we go on to the next series of questions that I have, you said something earlier about the need for a one-page registration process. I've gone through your registration process a few times, actually. Very simple. I think you only ask for use. Tell me if I'm wrong here. I think it's just the company name, the email address, and that subdomain name. So whatever.freshbooks.com. Once you give those three things to freshbooks.com, you've got an account, right?
Correct.
What's the thinking behind
Yeah,
making
and
it
then we have
that?
a page. I mean, it's about barriers to entry, right? If you're staring at a long form, we actually have a page. So then we take you to your subdomain and your login page, and you go in, you just click a button. We have a temporary password in there for you. And then we take you to a one-time setup page, which is actually a little lengthy. But the idea is if you fill that stuff in, you're going to have a better experience getting started. You could even imagine, I mean, you could maybe even do that one-page form. I guess what I'm advocating against is almost like a shopping cart aspect. We used to have a five-step process, which was, enter your username and password here. On the next step, put in your address. Excuse me. On the next step, agree to our user agreement. And so it was like three pages to do what could be effectively done in one page. So I thought that was a useful nugget for people in terms of, just getting people to go through the funnel, right? Because the more people you lose, just setting up their accounts, the more people you lose setting up their accounts. So you want them to get in there and be able to get to the value of using the service as quickly as possible.
What was the reasoning back in the early days for splitting that process up into multiple steps? Why'd you ask for a name, then address, then etc.?
I just thought it was better. I mean, I was looking at design. I mean, this is 2003. I was looking at this like it's a checkout process for a shopping cart. It had good usability. There are three blinking lights at the top, and you're on blinking light number one. And when you go to step two, like it was all clearly laid out. But for people, it's just like, man, this is such a pain. It's just faster to go down one form, be done with it.
Okay. All right. So what I want to ask about next is a setback. So far, it seems like this was all fairly easy with some learning along the way. Was there a period there where things got really rough and questionable?
I think the first, so we've been at this like 6.5 years now. I think the first 2.5, 3 years, anyone could probably characterize as rough and questionable, except I will say this is like we never saw it that way. We always just liked what we were doing and we believed in it and we were getting feedback from people using the service, even if they weren't paying us yet. And so we stayed committed to it. And we got better and smarter about thinking about these things and honing what it was that we did. And over time, we've evolved the business into what it is today. So I honestly think, I mean, smarter, like, it's gonna be a lot harder for me to start my second, if I ever start another business, it'll be a lot harder because I'll see a lot more obstacles. I'll have different expectations. But, ignorance is kind of bliss, and we just loved what we were doing. And so we just kept doing it. So that's the spirit of those times. And as I say, I think, smarter people would have deemed us a massive failure before, we ever even thought of ourselves that way for a second. So I think that's actually really important for people building businesses. Another thing, though, is kind of the classic thing is we got our name wrong. And we've seen a big difference in the business since we renamed the business. So it used to be called Second Sight. And you can find us at secondsight.biz, which is a terrible domain name. They didn't even have the .com. Second Sight, you can spell it like 10 different ways. It's totally forgettable. It doesn't talk about what we need to do. There's just so many problems with it. And so not having our brand right was bad. And we also, at that time, we really, I would say we had a very, we thought, I mean, we're working in a basement, you know, and I work in a t-shirt today and what have you. Like, we had a very internet communications in, you know, 99 through 2003 were about projecting this very, you know, I don't know how to describe it, but, you know, you need to project this uber professional image. And so we use like navy blue and gray as our colors because they're trusted like banking colors. And what we found is, you know, we started the business in 2004, we rebranded in 2006. And over that period of time, we just said, you know, who are we kidding, right? We're not, you know, we're not wearing suits to the office here. We show up every day, you know, we're totally professional about what we do, but, you know, we're pretty low-key guys. And, you know, and I think, you know, as the more we meet our customers, you know, these people are entrepreneurs, they're professionals themselves. They're also pretty low-key, hard-driving people who probably don't wear suits for the most part. And so it's okay to, you know, be ourselves, so to speak. And so instead of being a company with sort of a corporate face, being our website, we really changed our orientation to being, you know, quite, you know, Baron is so, you know, it's just not a great word, but we're just sort of more open. We do a better job of sharing our culture under the hood than we used to. And I think that's a really important thing to do. People want to do business with people. They don't want to do business with businesses.
How'd you rebrand? How'd you go from being called Second Sight? Were there pains involved in that?
Oh yeah. So you can literally, if you search for, you know, how to name a company, I wrote the Google article or the book on it. We learned a lot in this process, but basically we had an advisor who said, you know, I think you guys might want to consider, you know, changing your name. We were like, what are you talking about? It's great. And then we were like, wait a second. This is like the worst name that anyone has ever conceived of. And so we set about trying to rebrand it. And the reason that happened was because we were so busy and we had so little time, so little money, we didn't put much value in getting our name right. So we just, you know, we said, basically hurrying along, we got these three choices, let's pick one, let's go. And you know, that was like literally how strategic that decision was. We just need to get this over with so we can move on. You know, and in hindsight, naming your company is just so important. And we kind of were lucky because we got a chance to basically start over again. And it's been an enormously valuable thing for us to have done.
Well, we talked earlier about don't worry, be crappy, about just launching something and figuring it out later. Names are probably the most important, one of the most important pieces of a business. And here you were even able to change that. So does that then just emphasize the point that you should just launch something? It doesn't have to be perfect. You could even get one of the most important pieces of your business wrong, and you can still recover if you just launch.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, kind of fair to say. I would encourage people to spend more time and energy on getting their name right than we did. I don't think that, you know, if I had to do it over again, I wouldn't mess that part up. But I think there's a kernel in there that I totally agree with, which is there's still time. You know, there's still time to change. And I think people, you know, don't remember that. And they, you know, they fail because of it.
All right. And I'm still getting lots of great posts from Scott Mead. For anyone who's not listening to us live, first of all, you're missing this. And second, I'm going to see if I can post some of Scott Mead's tweets out so that people who are listening to us afterwards can see it. Also, Mia, thank you. She's quoting you here saying, I don't like ads in my applications, so I try to serve myself, the founder of FreshBooks. That's right. And that's a lot of it, right? As an entrepreneur, you can't figure out what everyone wants. You've got to sometimes say, this is what I like, and then let's see what their reaction is.
Yeah, I think in building, if you can have the option in building your business of having yourself as a customer, and scratching your own itch and building for your own needs, you know, I'm still effectively solving my own problems. I have, you know, I like to say I've got three problems to solve, and I've solved number one. It's like 60% complete, and I've got another one that I'm just spinning up and starting to work on, and there's a third problem to be solved, and they're all based out of, you know, they're all in line with this business. It's just different phases to it.
What's the second problem? Yeah.
I can't tell you.
So it hasn't launched yet, not even soft.
Yeah. So we don't talk too much about that kind of thing. In fact, you know, we don't even talk about our roadmap. We just like to do stuff.
Okay.
Actually, no, let's talk a little bit about that, because I hear from most people that when you have an idea, you should just put it out there. Ideas aren't valuable. It's all about execution. Get your idea out there, get feedback, and then you can build it more intelligently. But at the same time, I do hear your perspective too, and I want to understand that and give that perspective as much attention as I give the other side.
So I think the question is, do you want to be Bill Gates or do you want to be Steve Jobs?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Bill Gates, we're going to deliver Longhorn. It's going to be totally secure. It's going to be awesome. Big vision. It's coming. It's going to be awesome. You know, Steve Jobs, this is an iPod. This is how you can use it. Buy one today. And I don't know if it's like my consulting project managery background, but I'm a huge fan of low expectations. Okay. So I would rather keep expectations low and over deliver than, you know, speak bombastically about something, expectations really hyped up, and then under deliver, or, you know, upset some people who had a different vision when they heard your words or whatever it is. This is something I think that was set with our culture at the start as well. You know, sometimes I think to myself, geez, it'd be so awesome to talk about what's coming. People appeal to that, like, oh, it's coming. I'll just hang on. I'll go do that. And some people leave us for companies, you know, that are like, oh, you know, these guys say they're going to do that, so I'm going to leave you because you won't tell me anything. Mm-hmm. And then they go, and like a week later, we deliver it. So, but I just fundamentally would rather be delivering than talking. And I think it's really easy at some point, if you don't manage what you're talking about effectively and live up to those expectations, like every time you let somebody down, you crush their experience. And I mean, we have this like a little mantra here at FreshBooks. We call execute on extraordinary experiences every day. And so we got a million ideas. If you don't execute, you're nothing. So you got to execute. Extraordinary is like, if you're going to do something, just make sure it exceeds people's expectations. Now, the good news is people's expectations are incredibly low. They don't expect to get a real live person if they phone you. Well, we give them that experience, so we're extraordinary. Experiences, that's the business we believe that we're in. Okay, so we are in the business of whether you're using our web application and you get a funny message in there when you submit some time, or whether you get us on the phone, or, you know, I don't know what it is, but all these things are experiences. If we set your expectations and don't live up to them, you know, that's a very bad experience.
Okay? How do you go from, you have an idea, you want to release it, you don't want to tell people about it because you want to show them when it's released, but at the same time, you don't want to build this big thing that's out of touch with what they're looking for or that doesn't work the way they're looking for. How do you test it before you launch it? Do you bring people into your office and show it to them? Do you just start off with something small so that even if they don't like it, you can scrap it?
I think it's important to remember, like, you can launch whenever you say you launch. So you can be out in the wild having a service and people using it for a while, but until that day where you say you're launching, you're not officially launched.
I see.
Okay, I think people forget that. So you want to get people using a service, but when you actually launch the feature, that's the day it happened. You know, I think it's tough for people. Expectations are much higher than they used to be for applications like ours. So you want to make a good first impression. And I think it's perfectly okay to have a service out there being used for 6-7 months with a group of people, do some test marketing, develop a user base, and then declare your launch like after the fact.
I see. So that's the distinction right there. That's something that I talked to Eric Reese about in our interview. You're not just hiding it, building it internally without telling anyone, and then launching it on day one and saying, all right, world, love it. You are launching it somewhere small. You are getting some kind of feedback, but it's not a big splashy first day. And only after you're happy with it do you make that splash into the world.
I'll tell you this. If you've never met your users, I don't know why you're announcing a launch. Like, because what that means to me is you have no feedback from the marketplace. You don't know anything. You're a fool. You know, if you're doing product development and you're guessing, you are lost. So the faster you can get to users, you know, who are your sanity and reality check, who are going to start to tell you what you need to build instead of you thinking you know what you need to build, you know, the faster you can get there, the better off. So you need to get users. You need to have them use the product for a bit. And then telling your story the day you decide to launch is far more compelling because you're talking about people who are using the service and these are the benefits they get and la-da-da, all the rest of it.
That's something that I'm actually starting to see a little bit in my interviews too. Meet the users in person. bring you do that? You bring people into your office, you go out and you talk to them?
Well, we do more going out. So for years when we travel around, when I talked to a conference, I was in San Francisco like 3 weeks ago, and we host these things we call customer dinners. And basically, you know, a couple of days before I showed up, we sent an email to people in San Francisco. We had about 70 people come out for dinner. We bought dinner. It's our treat. And it's just one of our little ways that we sort of show the love for some of our customers. And, you know, they get to meet each other and, you know, and we get to meet them and hear about, you know, how they like the product and things of this nature.
I see. Okay.
I mean, I do think there's enormous value in meeting your users face to face. And I think for some developers, it's really hard to get their head around that. You know, I'll do it all by email or IM or whatever. It doesn't count. The telephone is good enough, if you ask me, frankly. You know, meeting people face to face is also awesome. Going to visit them in their environment to see what their office looks like and understand, you know, what that is also useful. You know, to see your product being used out in the wild without being, you know, influencing the environment. Getting on the phone and asking surveys, I've written some blog posts about this stuff. It is so important.
Wow. You know what? As you're saying it, I could see that it makes a lot of sense. I could see that it's different from what most people expect. And at the same time, it's a little intimidating. I can imagine somebody listening to this saying, that's a great thing. I should do that. And then when he's going out to get started, being intimidated. I hope they get past that intimidation.
Yeah. Well, get over it. If you want to be successful, I'll tell you, email doesn't cut it. Mm-hmm. You have to talk with people.
Okay. I've got a note here to talk to you about your culture. And I'll bring up the question about your culture by asking you about profitability. How much money are you guys making, Mike?
Yeah, we don't talk about the finances of the business, and we never have.
Okay, and I'm half kidding about asking you that question, because in the pre-interview you said that's part of your culture. That it's. Can you describe a little bit how that fits in with your culture and what your culture inside FreshBooks is like?
Okay, so I mean, the culture inside FreshBooks is awesome, but specifically as it pertains to sharing financial information, I'd say there's kind of two things. Cultures are kind of fascinating things, especially sitting here 6.5 years in, I realized like so much of our culture was set before we even started the business. I can't tell you. So we don't disclose financial information. And I think a big part of that actually comes from my mother, because she would never share financial information basically with anybody, including her own family in a lot of cases. She just like doesn't talk about it. It's a private thing. But I would also say another piece of that is it really fits with the nature of our service. We're helping manage people's financial information. There's a privacy, trust, and respect aspect to that. And, you know, we honor that, you know, with ourselves as well as with all our users.
I see. And I do see that you guys have a fairly open conversation with your users. Or what am I trying to say? I discovered FreshBooks because I had a conversation with one of your guys in a chat board on Hacker News. He went in. Somebody had an issue that had nothing to do with FreshBooks. He went in and he helped them with the issue. And I think he also said a disclosure, I'm part of FreshBooks. So I want you to know that I'm steering you in a direction that I care about, but also there's my background. What kind of interactions do you guys do beyond the usual phone calls and emails that most people don't even do?
Yeah, I was going to say, what's usual about this?
As I said usual, I said, wait a minute, it's only usual because we use it to talk to our families and our friends, but companies don't do that. But you guys do something else. You talked about Twitter before. This is an example of some of me seeing you guys in my world at Hacker News. How else are you guys doing it?
Oh, I mean, we take people out to dinner, right? Like all over, whenever we travel, pull out a customer send an email to customers in that area and invite them out and treat them to dinner. We're having technically we launched in May 2004. Even though the company was founded in January 2003. And so actually tomorrow night, we're having our 5th year birthday party. We're going to have like a picnic with 3-legged races, and there are going to be loot bags and all the rest of it here in Toronto. I think we've got something, you know, I don't know, in the neighborhood of 100 people who are coming out to join us for this thing. I think it's really easy to think like a technical person and think that everything's online and technical. But the fact is, like, online relationships are often forged offline, and you need to get out and meet people. And I think it's really easy to, you know, sit back and, you know, just sit on the other side of your computer and think I can do it all from here. But the fact is that, you know, there will be exceptions to every rule. But It's a one in a million that you can do it without getting out and meeting people. So you got to get over that and you got to do it. And that's, you know, we strive to make it easy for people to approach us. We our goal is, you know, to support the people who use our service and the communities in which we operate. And, you know, that is what we do. And I think that example on Hacker News is, I think I even know who that was. And he's an avid reader, you know, and participant in that community. And he thought he could offer some value in that situation. So he did. And, you know, I think that's a nice reflection of a lot of our values here. And I think even just being open and honest about where he was coming from is another great example of some of our cultures here, right?
Yeah, I mean, how many people will have a separate fake account and then go in and see the answers? All right, finally, I like to get advice from entrepreneurs for younger or newer entrepreneurs. And specifically what I'm hearing a lot of is people who've been now struggling for the last year or so because the economy is tough and they're building their business. It's not happening overnight. You've gone through, you said, 2 years of struggle. Do you have any advice for some, 2 years, not struggle, but 2 years of trying to build it up? Do you have any advice for somebody who's going through a situation where it's taking longer than they imagined?
Yes. Remember that you define success.
I see.
Just think about how powerful that is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You define success. You might think, like, I think people have expectations, but have you ever, you know, questioned those expectations? You know, and where did they come from anyways? And would you be happy if this thing didn't turn out to be as big as you wrote out in a piece of paper a while ago? Are you still happy doing what you're doing? Like, I encourage people to set their own metrics. And sometimes those metrics are like, how many happy emails did we get from customers this month? Because we're not getting paid, we're not making money. But if we got 10 emails this week or this month, maybe that's enough to get us by. It tells us we're on the road and we're going to keep doing that. So you need to define your own success. And I think that that can fundamentally shift the way you look at things. We started the business in January 2003. The market was not in a good place. I would say we spent more than 2.5 years of struggling away. You know, frankly, I'd say it's closer to like 4. You know, and it's all how you define it. It's all how you look at it. You know, you're kidding yourself. You know, sometimes you have real world obligations. Like if you have a family, you know, and you need to support them financially and, you know, you're not able to make ends meet. Okay. I understand that. But if you're not in that scenario and you love what you do and you can see some, you know, sense of success, however you define it, you know, I'd just say stick with it. And it always takes longer than you think, right? 1 year, talk to me in 3 or 4.
Yeah, I've got here in my notes you saying that when you were building it up, or in the early days, you weren't making money, but you were getting positive feedback from your users. You were seeing more people use the site. Kind of reminded me of an interview that I did with Greg from JibJab. His whole business basically went away. He had to lay off all his people. And then he started off fresh here in California, and he didn't have much money. And I asked him, why'd you keep going? He said, well, we kept getting great emails from people, and we knew that they liked our stuff.
Soul food, man.
Yeah.
Emails and certain books. You know, it may sound silly, but I just remember reading Seth Godin's Idea Virus. And I swear to God, that thing, it's like 120 pages. It kept me going for like a half year, like 6 months. Just think about that book. And man, this is going to be, you know, we just believed in what we were doing and we were passionate about it. And, you know, how do you hang a price tag on that?
Do you have another book that you can recommend? I know people keep looking for books from these interviews.
I'm not sure that's the first book I would recommend these days. Like I haven't read it in so long that, you know, I can barely remember, you know, about it. It's so funny. I can't remember. I could follow up with you with like a list of books that are useful for building businesses.
Anytime
if you, want.
You have them, I know our people would love it.
Yeah, I just blank when I'm asked to remember.
I do too. I've got all these books behind me. You'd think I'd be able to come up with one when somebody asks me, but how do you come up with one? It's not like I only read one. If I only read one, boom, I'd keep making that the answer to every question. Yeah. All right. Well, is there anything that I missed here? Anything that people need to know about your company?
Well, I mean, it just makes me want to go to like marketing land. Just make sure everybody knows that, you know, FreshBooks is an online invoicing and bookkeeping service for professionals who get paid for their time and expertise. You get yourself your own free account at FreshBooks.com, and Yeah, come try us out. Give us a call afterwards. Let us know how the service is. And yeah, stay in touch.
Yeah, try it. Tell me what you think, guys. Just go to FreshBooks. As you saw, it's just one page and it's very easy to fill out. Seconds. All right. Well,
cheers.
Thank you. Thank you, Mike. Thanks for coming on here and talking about this. Thanks for all the time.
Thanks for having me, Andrew.
You bet.
Cheers.
And there it is. As always, I want to ask you to come back and give me feedback. Tell me what you thought of the interview, the audio, the video, the ideas here. The more you tell me, the better. But I also am noticing from reading the comments and reading the emails that I get that a lot of people listen to these interviews with a pen and paper and take notes. If you're one of those people, then I'd love to see some of the notes that you took. Put them in the comments if you feel comfortable doing them already, and I hope you do. I want other people to learn from you the way that we're all learning from Mike and others who've come here to Mixergy to tell you their experiences and what they've learned along the way. So I hope if you've written any notes for yourself that you share them with others and let them learn. And if you haven't, you might want to start doing that now. Find a way to just jot down a couple of notes as you listen to these interviews, and I'm telling you that those messages that you write down will stick with you more. You see me sometimes in my interviews write down what I'm learning, and you can see that, and I can tell you actually, I don't know that you can see it directly, I can tell you that the ideas that I write down stick with me more and become a more natural part of my life, and I know that you'll find the same. And by the way, if you're like me digitally, and you listen digitally, if you're listening on an iPhone or device like that, stop, take a note even on that digital device. Anywhere where you take a note, I'm telling you, what you write down is going to stick with you a lot longer than what you just listen to passively. Also, find a way to connect with FreshBooks. Check out their website, see what they're about, sign up for them if it's an appropriate fit for you. I don't want to do a commercial for them here. I just want to tell you that if you listen to somebody here and you take notes, you're going to learn a lot more. If you listen, take notes, and then connect with them, you're going to go even further because you're connecting with the people there, because you're building a relationship. And it doesn't have to be something elaborate like a long email saying, hey, Mike, I've seen your site and I heard you on Mixergy. It could just be a short, hey, heard you on Mixergy, checked out your website, thanks for teaching us. That's it. Thanks for teaching me. I learned a lot from you. That little touch is a great way to connect with somebody. And then if you see them at a conference or somewhere else, you can build on that relationship, but you've established the foundation by just saying, hey, thank you. All right. Finally, click around Mixergy.com. I've got tons of other interviews for you to listen to with entrepreneurs like Mike who want to tell you what they've learned in business, with investors, with so many other people. Click around and listen to others. Keep learning and keep taking notes. I'm Andrew. I'll see you in the comments.